please. They have been helpful.
A lot of people seem to be concerned about the rights of lawyers.
Yeah. Is this a bar association meeting? They came to Harris Weather here, right here, right there. They didn't see. They're going to file back in. They're going to file back in to see you.
I didn't think we had person, but so. I bet.
All right, counsel, can you proceed, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Amabile, and I represent Christian Morley, the appellant, and we seek an order reversing the judgment of the Northern District of Illinois after a jury trial and the remand for a new trial. In this case, the district court stripped the defendant of his defense by denying submitting the question of fair use to the jury for its consideration, thereby denying him a fair trial. The basic issue before this court is whether or not the factual issue of fair use should have been submitted to the jury in this prosecution for non-commercial copyright infringement. This is a case I would suggest that
Why
I could
do you
find.
Call this non-commercial?
I call it non-commercial, Your Honor, because the indictment, first of all, does not allege any private commercial gain or private financial gain as required in one section of the copyright law.
No, let me. You may not see the reason I'm asking this question. This network worked by barter, but barter is just a form of payment. The only way you could get access to these servers to download the software was by putting up assets of your own, software, your software, or servers, or hard disks, or something. And a barter economy is still an economy. The fact that they used assets other than Federal Reserve notes does not, it seems to me, make this non-commercial or a non-exchange economy. It just combines copyright infringement with tax evasion.
No, I would disagree with the court's characterization for this reason. The court, and again the district court, was focusing on the act of copying and distribution of the material. But under both the statute and copyright law, that does not constitute copyright infringement.
Well, wait a minute, because I wanted to take you to Section 107. The district court looked at that language and at the law construing it and concluded that there was simply no way this case raised anything that could be characterized as copying for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching. You don't hide the servers in the closet if it's for teaching, scholarship, or research. And then the factors follow that, but 107 defines the fair use region, if you will, and I have to say it's awfully hard to characterize these people with this complex subscription-only barter system as doing anything like any of those.
Well, Your Honor, again, the focus has to be put on how the members of this group use the copyrighted material. Not that they traded it, not that they copied it, not that they distributed it. And I think that if you looked at the Sony case, which is the major Supreme Court case in this area.
I'm familiar with the Sony case.
Well, the Sony case, you're talking there, Your Honor, about literally millions of copies of copyrighted material being reproduced for private use. That's precisely what was occurring in this case.
Sony was not sued as an infringer. Sony was sued as a contributory infringer.
Well, that's correct.
There's no claim of contributory infringement in this
case. That is correct, Your Honor, but again, the issue of fair use was on the table in that case, and that was the central area that case was decided under.
The question was whether it was possible to use the Betamax machine in a way that would be consistent with fair use. That was answered as an abstract yes. That answered the contributory infringement question. We don't have to ask the question whether it is possible to distribute software in a way consistent with fair use. That's not at all the question in this case.
Your Honor,
actually have some facts here.
Well, I would suggest that the jury should have been given the issue of whether the activity at issue in this case constituted fair use.
Only if the facts in the light most favorable to the defendants could make out a fair use defense.
And I suggest they clearly do. The facts that I would point to are this. First of all, this was private. This was not material that was put out over the airwaves for general consumption.
So if a group of students at the University of Illinois get together and decide that they'll just create this very same kind of network so that only one person needs to buy a copy of each piece of software, you think that's automatically fair use?
Your Honor, it's not automatically fair use, but it does give rise to the issue. I suggest that it is.
And if I'm teaching a class at the University of Chicago, I can take an article from a law review that's copyrighted by my colleague Frank Easterbrook and make as many copies as I want for teaching?
Your Honor, Your Honor, let me just say this.
Do you agree with her argument?
No, I don't.
Why?
I would say you don't agree
with what she said.
I would say that Your Honor could take Judge Easterbrook's article and you could distribute it, and if you were criminally prosecuted for that conduct, the question of whether that was a fair use
for educational purposes.
The
only possible defense in that case would be that as a matter of law, the article had no commercial value. And perhaps that's something which we could just take judicial notice.
I do not agree that that's a correct statement of the law. The question
now you're
of
trying
use,
to play us to frame.
Well, I am too, Your Honor, as best I can. But the purpose of copyright under the Constitution is to promote learning and the dissemination of useful arts and science. And what this group was doing was trading information for private viewing.
And bartering it.
But, Your Honor, here's the question, though. It's with respect to my client, Chris Morley, there wasn't one shred of evidence that he actually even made use of any of the programs at all, that he even opened them up. Your Honor.
He received them, though, didn't
he? He copied them, but under both the statute and copyright law, simply copying them doesn't constitute a violation. The focus here has to be on what use was put to them. Now, in terms of any party, this group was an avowedly non-commercial association.
Now we're back to your claim that barter makes something non-commercial, even though using money as a medium of exchange would be commercial, and I don't see why a barter economy is non-commercial.
Your Honor, let me give you this hypothetical. Let's say 50 people got together, each bought one book, and they traded them amongst themselves for the purpose of discussing them. That's bartering, I suppose. In the same way that having a private library is bartering.
Depends on what you mean by trading. Copyright law is about copying. If 50 people just circulate the book, no copies have been made, and there's no problem.
Respectfully, Your Honor.
But if each person makes 50 copies and distributes it to the rest of the group in exchange for the 50 copies from them, there is no conceivable fair use defense.
Respectfully, Your Honor, legally, copyright law is not limited to copying. Distribution is a violation if the use of the distributed material is unreasonable. And that's the standard, again, under the Harper and Roe case. Merely trading material, intellectual property, ideas, is not a copyright violation. And in this case, we don't have to get to the question of whether there was actually a copyright violation. The issue is, should the district court, in this case, which I think is the first case which was brought under a statute that no longer requires you to prove private financial gain or commercial advantage. In those contexts where you're taking the commercial property and you're selling it for your own personal benefit, then clearly there is a question of unreasonable use. But in this case, that's not what was going on at all. I see my time is up, and unless there are any other questions, I would ask you to simply review my brief, and I would ask the court to reverse the judgment, give my client a fair trial where this issue is fairly submitted to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Yes, sir. Always.
Thank you, sir. The court, please. Prosecution. We ask a simple question. Did the district court resolve the value of these pirated materials correctly? We take the position the district court clearly erred, and the standard of review for the amount of loss is de novo. Now, I don't pretend to understand all that is part of this case. What I do understand is that the district court disregarded, in theory, the evidentiary testimony of Mr. Hamblett, who is the computer guru that the government put up as a witness. He indicated that his program, a mystic logarithmic program, divined 54,000 programs.
Right. Well, we know that, and he cut even the adjusted number down to about 10% of what it was.
That is correct.
34,000-some to 3,700-some. It strikes me that the district court was quite aware of the points that you're making about evaluating the infringing product, not the valid product, and he took extraordinarily conservative steps to make sure he was doing this right and came up with a number that could have been many times what you got. So I don't really see where he clearly erred, and I don't see where he was applying the wrong legal
path. If I may, the district court credited one particular series of evaluations here, and that was that the district court said that 71 programs were tested and 67 fully functioned, and that is the equation the district court used.
Yes, because 94% of the number that
the difficulty had. Is they were not selected at random, and the random testing would not have yielded 94%.
Did you do a correct random test?
We did not know what the government's random testing was until the evidentiary proceeding.
No, my question is...
The answer is no.
The answer is no.
The answer is no.
Of course, you could have done it since sentencing.
Well, the district court, after issuing the order of February 102, declined to receive any further submissions vis-a-vis calculation.
You could argue to us that the district court was in error if you had said, for example, we got surprised, we've now done a statistically valid random sampling, and here are the results.
And the government would say that's not in the record, Your Honor, and therefore it cannot be considered. No, what's telling here, and this is the position the defense takes, is that the district court at first blush said he was not relying on Agent Hamblett's analysis.
Right, that was off the table.
But he then used that same analysis in order to determine that there was 94% fully functioning programs not taken at random.
Well, and he explains why. He says, why don't I have the same result as I did for the larger number? And he says, because I find it logical to expect that the programs that they kept on the site were the ones that worked. So he has a reason. He tells us his reason.
Well, the position we've taken is obviously contrary, and
okay,
it's set out in our briefs. And
well,
I'd also
like a clear error argument, basically.
Well, if the standard of review is de novo, which we believe it is under the 2F1.1 standard, then this court has the plenary opportunity to consider that which the district court looked at fresh. And I would point out, and the government seemingly agrees, that it's an odd case because there is no authority directly on point. Thank you, Judge Coffey.
Thank you, counsel.
And I would take the law review article.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Please.
I'm addressing first the fair use question raised by Defendant Christian Morley. It has always been consistently the government's position, in fact, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, that it is not properly termed a non-commercial use of the software when you have what is effectively a barter economy, as you did on the Sentinel site at issue in this case. I think it is important, though, to even move beyond that issue and look at the other statutory factors that are necessary to make out the affirmative defense of fair use. Even assuming that it were an entirely non-commercial purpose for the software, there's nothing whatsoever in the record to indicate that any other aspect of the fair use defense has been demonstrated. This case is not about fair use. It is about free use of software. It was repeatedly characterized by the district court as a case of outright theft, and that is effectively what happened. For the defendant to argue that there is something educational about this use merely because the hardware that was operating the site was hidden at a university up in Canada, operated without the consent of that university, and without being utilized by any students, is patently ridiculous.
What happened to the professor who was involved in this, which looks like it's not only stealing hardware from Intel, but stealing bandwidth from the university?
In terms of his status in the case, he began cooperating with law enforcement early on in the investigation after being approached by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who had in turn been approached by the FBI, and he enabled the law enforcement who had gone up to Canada to obtain the Sentinel site, and it was not charged as a defendant in this case.
Well, probably not in this case. Is he still a member of the engineering faculty?
Is he teaching there yet?
I don't believe that he is, Your Honor, but to be honest, I'm not sure of his
probably
status at this time.
Chicago.
But in any event, I don't think any argument can be made that he was teaching anything with regard to the thousands of software programs that were running through the site at this time.
Remind me what the overall number of people involved in this group was?
There were over 100 people involved in the group. There were 17 defendants in the case. And over time, there were thousands of people who had access to the software on the site.
Who had access to the same software.
That's correct. And in fact, that
all
number,
for educational purposes.
It would be the government's contention that none of it was for educational purposes. And that number, of course, it's important for the court to understand, both with regard to this issue and with regard to the loss calculation, that it's multiplied exponentially. Because once these programs were uploaded to the sites that were operated by this group, they were then couriered from that site to numerous other sites. They were transferred to other groups, and they continue to be disseminated over the Internet in ways that we cannot even calculate.
Does the record show any of that path?
It does in some cases. For example, the Pirates with Attitudes group had 13 sites that they were operating. The conspiracy that we charged was only with regard to one of those 13 sites, and that's the Sentinel site that is discussed at length in the record. So we do know that the same programs were couriered by other defendants in the case who testified extensively at trial about their activities to the group's other sites, and that from there they were then transferred to other wares or piracy groups that also use those. So to a certain extent we can trace the uploading of these programs from one group to another and from one site to another. After that, of course, it becomes impossible because they're downloaded an infinite number of times. There's no way to measure who and where these programs ultimately end up, although it is certainly the case that in numerous piracy investigations conducted in both civil and criminal cases, you find copies of these programs way far down the chain of distribution that have been originally uploaded to the Internet by this group or by other piracy groups like them. Although they describe themselves as an exclusive club in the initial stages, it clearly has an impact far beyond the small group of individuals who are involved. A couple of other points on the fair use defense. It is also not the case that there is anything even remotely transformative, or what this court, in Judge Posner's Thai opinion, called complementary about the use to which the software is put. It is not a parody. there is no review. Not one of these defendants at any point published a review of the software or reported to a software company about glitches that they may have observed in the software. It is an exact digital duplicate of the program. It encompasses the entire work. So it is a substitute, or what other courts have called a superseding use of the work, and therefore the Ferries defense necessarily fails. And as we've discussed, it does have an impact on the market. And the government is not claiming that it has demonstrated any actual displaced sales of particular software programs. But the case law is very clear that in order to defeat the fair use defense, you need only show a general harm to the market for the infringed upon work. You do not need to show any actual present harm, and you do not even need to demonstrate any certain future harm. You need only demonstrate some impact on the market, and that was clearly done in this case. And I think finally, and most importantly, on the fair use defense, one of the aspects that the court is to consider when evaluating whether that instruction should have been given is whether the defendant otherwise was insured of a fair trial. And in this case, the defendant, Christian Morley, clearly was, because the jury was instructed that in order to convict him of the offense, it had to find that he acted willfully. And it was instructed that that meant that it had to find that he did not act in good faith. And therefore, if the jury had really believed from the evidence presented at trial that the defendant had some educational purpose or motivation for the 8,000 software programs that he personally downloaded to his computer, or for the 50,000 overall that the group was responsible for, it certainly could have acquitted him.
You wouldn't argue that in a case where the record might have supported some kind of fair use defense, maybe the only thing he was doing was using it in some little seminar he was teaching or something, that a willfulness instruction is a substitute for a fair use instruction.
It is not a substitute, but it is in a certain respect a fail-safe, because the evidence did not support a fair use defense, and I think that is abundantly clear. But if by some extreme definition of the notion of fair use, the defendant truly thought that he had presented evidence that indicated that he had merely acted in good faith and was doing so for an educational purpose, it was the instructions as a whole ensured him of a fair trial, and that is one of the factors that the court is to look at in determining whether a theory of defense was improperly refused. With regard to the loss calculation, I do believe that the standard of review is clear error. The defendants have not pointed to any legal error made by the district court. In fact, the district court's opinion is a very lengthy, very careful, and very reasoned approach to what was clearly a difficult issue. It is an approach the district court took informed by extensive briefing and argument, by hearings, by expert testimony, and by numerous reports. And so the district court absorbed and ruled on extensive factual analysis, and the standard the court should be applying is clearly whether there was some clear error in calculating the loss. And
but wasn't it the government's burden to present some evidence about what these products would have commanded on, or implicitly commanded on, a black market?
Your Honor, I don't believe that is the case, because what the sentencing guidelines call for is for the court to make a reasonable estimate of loss. That's true in every case.
The value of the infringing product.
That's
right?
Correct.
The old guidelines, yeah.
But there are, and we're looking, again, yes, of course, we're looking at the guidelines prior to the May 2000 amendments, which did require the court to determine the value, not the price, but the value of the infringing items. And there are many cases that indicate where that value is very, very difficult to ascertain. As a baseline, the court can look to the retail price as one indicator of value. And then, as Your Honor has pointed out, the court found many ways to adjust that number downward to account for the fact that we're not talking about retail distribution of these programs. So where there is no particular black market value, where the court is not confronted with a choice, as it is in some other cases in other counterfeit contexts, between what a counterfeit item is actually being sold for and the original infringed upon item, but rather has no baseline other than the retail price, it is appropriate for the court to look to that, to use that as a ceiling,
yeah,
as many courts have indicated, and then to adjust accordingly according to the facts of the case.
Are you relying at all on the particular quality of digital counterfeits, which, as you said a minute ago, aside from the obviously the copy protection features and some of the other protective features, these were perfect copies. I can imagine, a Christian Dior gown and somebody coming up with a counterfeit that really wasn't fabric that was quite as good or workmanship, maybe it would carry a lower price on a market, or those Rolex knockoffs that you can buy for $5, up and down Fifth Avenue. But are these copies, are these infringing products somehow uniquely close to the genuine product?
They are not just close to, they are materially indistinguishable. Those are the exact words that the district court used. And that was a factor that was very, very important to the district court's analysis. And of course, I agree with Your Honor that it is critically important to the loss evaluation that was done here, because we are not talking about items that differ. And in other contexts, in cases where we're not even talking about exact digital duplicates, for example, Beanie Babies, where they're reproduced with such authenticity that it is impossible for the consumer to distinguish between the original and the inauthentic item, the courts have said it is appropriate to look to retail price as a way of calculating the quote-unquote value of that infringing item. And here we have exact digital duplicates, as you pointed out. So I think that it makes it even more appropriate to use that as the starting as a baseline, as a way to begin the calculation. And of course, in the year and a half, and I want to take exception to one thing that counsel said about this, all of the data, all of the reports, everything that the government relied on, including the testing and the evaluations of the functionality of the programs, were consistently and repeatedly made available to the defense. They had over a year and a half between the extensive discovery in this case and the final sentencing hearing, and at no point did the defendants proffer any analysis concerning functionality, any retail prices, or any alternative methodology for a baseline or for a way to calculate. And finally, just with regard to the expert testimony that the court did discount, it is true that the district court determined that the 30 to 50,000 programs that were apparent from the log files found on the Sentinel site could not be included in the value calculation. However, that is a separate issue entirely from the question of how to value the 5,000 programs that actually were software programs existing on the Sentinel site at the time that the site was seized by law enforcement. So the questions as to the statistical analyses and the actual testing of the functionality are not aspects of the expert testimony that were discounted in any way by the district court. And the credibility of those tests and of that evidence was never called into question. So I think the district court did, again, take a very reasoned approach, did calculate a very difficult circumstance, but did do so using extensive data that was unchallenged, that was undisputed, essentially, at the hearing, and came up with a reasoned estimate of the value of these items. And we would ask the court to affirm both the defendant Christian Morley's
conviction
and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We take the case under advisement. You've got just 1 minute.
Your Honors, I'd just like to briefly speak about two points. One, when we talk about the factors that are outlined, the non-exclusive factors that determine fair use, we are, as my colleague has just made abundantly clear, we're arguing about the facts, and as Judge Scalia said in the Gordon case, in criminal prosecutions, when we're talking facts, we're talking a jury issue, and that's what I'm saying in this case. Secondly, as far as the general dissemination of this material outside of the group, if you comb the record, you will see that there is no evidence that any specific program in evidence in this case showed up anywhere else but on the sites referenced in the prosecution of this case. There were general, vague characterizations, but no specific evidence of that whatsoever. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement and proceed to case number 3, please.